This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you
fire.
Hi there, this is Alex. I've been working on the latest science about wildfires and climate change. The plan was to save the broadcast for summer, you know, when the fires start. Nature isn't waiting. This is news from the first week of April.
Wildfires broke out up and down the East Coast Monday, fueled by whipping winds and dry conditions.
The wind just blows it, keeps it blowing, pushes it farther and farther.
On New York's Long Island, hundreds of firefighters race to keep flames from closing in on a nuclear physics facility.
Forget about normal. Wildfire season started ridiculously early this year. For example, this from CBS News.
Government forecasters say that 2012 has started out warmer than any year on record. Last month was 8.6 degrees warmer than normal, and there were more than 15,000 record-high temperatures in March. All 50 states set at least one record this morning. Fires are burning in nine states from New Hampshire to Florida, where it is already Wildfire Awareness Week. Wow.
The blessing many found in a snowless winter, 20 inches below average in New York City, is quickly becoming the firefighter's curse.
It's time for the Radio EcoShock special, my recordings of a session on fire and climate. The fire experts gathered at the February Conference of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver 2012. You'll hear how fires make a hotter climate, which feeds more fires, the cycle of positive feedback. An internationally recognized wildfire expert, Dr. Michael Flanagan, reports on the latest science and experience in the field. Flanagan also describes a new risk that could tip the climate of the world. You may have a personal stake in this. Anyone with lungs does. From the University of British Columbia School of Medicine, Dr. Michael Brower explains new ways of tracking dangerous smoke, which can travel thousands of miles across international boundaries. I like Brower's talk because he also tells us how citizens can protect themselves during a smoke event. Finally, we'll hear from Dr. Faye Johns from the University of Tasmania. She was part of a team asking the big question, how many people die every year from fire smoke? The answer, and the places most at risk, may surprise you. Let's get the big picture from one of my favorite wildfire experts. Dr. Michael Flanagan is a professor at the Department of Renewable Resources at the University of Alberta. He's the senior research scientist at the Canadian Forest Service. His PhD is from Cambridge, and he's trained in meteorology. Flanagan is editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Wildfire and part of the U.S. Assessment on Global Change. Mike is a leader in the newly formed Western Partnership for Fire Science. We're going to hear excerpts from my recording of Mike Flanagan's presentation at Forest Fires in Canada, Impacts of Climate Change and Fire Smoke, delivered Sunday morning, February 19, 2012, in a special workshop at the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver.
So, what do we know about fire on the landscape across the globe? Well, about, and I do say about, 350 to 450 million hectares burns every year. And for context, that's the size of India. We have no clue as to how many fire starts there are in the globe, but we guess that about humans are responsible for 90% of them. The largest area burns are in grasslands and savannas. In many ecosystems, fire is a necessary component. You'd see lots of fire in Africa, Australia, and Southeast Asia, and less so in Siberia and Canada, United States, and a fair bit of fire in the Amazon as well. So let's talk about people and fire. It's a two-way street. Humans impact fire, land use change, clearing, abandonment, building cities. We try to manage fire. Some places it's truly fire suppression. Some human-caused ignitions are accidental, but some are deliberate arson fires, and arson fires seems to be on the rise. And of course, the flip side is fire impacts humans. Loss of life, infrastructure, evacuations, air quality, which we'll hear a fair bit about, water quality, fire suppression costs, indirect effects like climate change, and ecological aspects like biodiversity. Now, fire management globally, there's a wide range from the most sophisticated computer-aided decision support helicopters to using brooms for fire management. So a wide range of activities. Many billions of dollars are spent. In Canada, we're averaging about $800 million a year, though this year, or 2011, we went over a billion. The United States is several billion. California alone usually spends a billion or more. Fire management is replacing fire suppression in some regions. It's a balancing act between protection of human life and values at risk and protecting the environment and the ecology. So this is how I view the world of forest fires or wildland fires. There's four key factors. And really what I'm looking at is not an individual fire, but looking at fire over a landscape, over a period of time, say a couple of weeks to a month to a season. And these ingredients or factors are fuel, how much fuel, how moist it is, how it is structured. If it's a forest, does it have ladder fuels? That's an understory to carry the fire from the surface to the crowns. You can't have a fire if you don't have ignition. And there's two primary types, human and lightning. And of course, there's weather. And I unabashedly think that weather is the most important factor. Things like temperature, precipitation, atmospheric moisture, upper conditions, blocking ridge or mega blocks, solar radiation, and there's climate patterns like ENSO, Atlantic multi-decadal oscillation also influences fire activities. And last, the first three are natural factors and would operate if there was no people on the landscape. The last one are people, but we are on the landscape and we fragment and we manage fire, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what's interesting here is that weather is a component of the first three in that fuel moisture is a critical consideration. And fuel moisture is directly controlled by the weather. Also, lightning, one of the ignition factors, is also controlled by the weather, and weather is its own factor. So in terms of options, if these are the things that are driving fire, what can we control? Well, we can't really control the weather. So the only options are fuel and human-caused ignitions. So we should be spending more time on prevention, education, restricted fire zones, reduce or eliminate industrial activity during periods of high fire danger. And we can modify the fuel. And programs like FireWise, FireSmart already doing that. Fuel breaks, changing the fuel load, fuel type at the landscape level, which probably isn't too effective, or near areas of high value like communities. So now we're going to talk about climate change. And the GCMs predict temperature changes of 1.4 to 5.8 degrees Celsius by 2100. Greatest increase is at high latitudes over land in winter and spring, though over the Arctic Ocean, because the ice may be seasonal by mid-century, there will be significant increases in temperature over the Arctic Ocean. Projected increases in extreme weather, heat waves, droughts, floods, windstorms, ice storms, etc. And the two graphs here, one is showing observed temperature, and this is from a while ago, it just shows temperature change per decade. And the warmer yellows and oranges are warming and the blues are cooling. And you see a pattern that not everywhere is warming, but over land, northern areas. And I compare that with projection from the Canadian model for 2050. And you see a somewhat similar pattern to what's happening. And once again, it's warming, in some places significant warming, over the Arctic Ocean because the ice is probably seasonal now. But there are areas where there's no change or cooling, and that's due to ocean currents. So a big part for fire is variability, and it's because fire is usually a result of extreme. Just a few critical days are responsible for most of the area burned. Sometimes you have fire and then you have a flood because you have increased runoff. Other parts of the world, you have floods and then you have fire, like Australia, the central dry area. You have flooding, which increases production of vegetation, which then dries out in the next dry spell and then burns. And things like wind. The projections are, for most regions, the average wind speed is not going to change a great deal, but we expect to see high, more extreme high wind speeds in the future. And those are the days when the fires spread. And those are the days we have to watch for. So if the extremes are increasing, even though the average isn't, we still have a big problem. And by 2100, it's a much warmer world, according to this simulation. Temperatures of 5-6 degrees warming, which is a very significant warming. You do see areas, once again, of a little change or perhaps even a little bit of cooling, southern oceans and near Labrador. But it is a much warmer world if these models are anywhere close to reality. This is work done by Nathan Gillette back in 2004, and he looked at area burned in Western Canada. And is it changing, increasing? In that paper, we suggest that the increase in area burned we've seen in Canada, which has been a doubling already, is due to human-caused climate change. So one of the key factors in this increase in fire that we've seen already in Canada and in other parts of the globe, and what we expect to see in the future, is because of increased temperature. And, you know, I get asked, well, why is temperature so important? Well, there's three reasons. And the first is that increased temperature drives evapotranspiration, which drives how dry the fuels will be. Generally, the fuels are going to be drier, so it's easier for fires to start and spread. The exception is if there's an increase in precipitation, and for every degree of warming, you need about a 10% increase in precipitation to keep the fuel moisture approximately the same. So, and most of the models do not suggest that kind of increase in precipitation, so the fuels are drier. Second, temperature has a strong positive correlation with lightning. So the warmer it is, the more lightning we have, and the more fire starts. Though I need to do some more literature search to see how strong that correlation is. Third, the warmer it is, the longer the fire season. And this is particularly important at northern latitudes. The graph shows 2011 annual surface temperature across the globe. 2011 was the ninth warmest year, even though there was a La Nina for most of the year. And 9 of the 10 warmest years on record have been this century. 1998 was the exception, and that was a strong El Nino year. There's a number of papers that talk about temperature and fire, and I cite the paper by Parisian et al. In Ecological Applications, published last year. Now, this is work that's been done in Canada, and this just showed projections of area burned. And once again, the key variable was temperature and fuel moisture, and it showed about a doubling of area burned in Canada for a three times CO2 scenarios or equivalents by the Canadian and Hadley model. In the eastern Canada, they're very similar. In the western Canada, there are some divergences. It's because the Canadian model is a little cooler and wetter than that Hadley run. So this is work by Mike Balshi and others, and he used a MARS approach and using A2, B2 or for western Canada, Alaska. And depending on which scenario and what time, mid-century, late century, we're looking at 2.5 to 5.5 times increase in area burned. So that's significantly more than the earlier one, which was a doubling. So there was a literature review done a few years ago looking at global fire and climate change. And the majority of the studies suggest area burned increases, though there was very few global studies at that time. Fire and currents increases, fire season increases. The message was more mixed with respect to fire intensity and fire severity. And one example of fire occurrence was published by Mike Watton and others looking at changes in fire occurrence in Canada caused by lightning and human-caused. And it's done by ecoregion, provincial ecoregion, and that's human-caused 2090, and that's lightning-caused. And we see some areas of no change, but we do see significant areas of increases. They did not change the lightning frequency. The increases in lightning-caused fires is due to drier fuels. So this gets me to the point where the most recent work I've done, it was just completed last Monday, and we're using the Canadian Forest Fire Danger Rating System, which is used across Canada and many parts of the world. Many of the global products use the Canadian system. We used something called a cumulative DSR to determine the severity of the fire season. The DSR is a function of the fire weather index, which is a measure of the intensity of the fire, and it provides a measure of how difficult it is to suppress a fire. So what I'm driving at here is, if fire increases in the future like we expect, how much will this affect fire management capabilities? And I also looked at changes in fire season length. So for the baseline observed data, used NSEP reanalysis data to determine the Canadian FWI system, including the DSR for 71 to 2000. Three emission scenarios, the standard IPCC 3, A1B, A2, B1, for three GCMs, Canadian, Hadley, and French. We superimposed anomalies from the future decade over the baseline and calculated a ratio. And we also calculated change in fire season length. On the picture here, this is Moa's picture showing fires in Quebec, driving smoke down into the eastern seaboard, New York, Washington. In Canada, we export hockey players, cold fronts, and now we export smoke.
You are listening to a presentation by Dr. Mike Flanagan, one of Canada's top fire experts. This is Radio EcoShock with a recording from the 2012 meeting of the AAAS.
And you can see most of the globe, especially in the north, this is mid-century, is a significant increase. Now, many of these increases were showing a doubling to tripling of DSR, which is a very significant increase. So if I go ahead to layer century, this is still a B1 scenario, and I'll toggle back and forth so you can see that it is getting worse as the century progresses, and much more agreement in North America as we move along. The Canadian was the coolest model and the wettest model. The other two models, the French and the Hadley, were in much closer agreement than the Canadian model. It's interesting that Africa isn't doing a great deal in the B1 scenario. So let's move to A1B. This is mid-century, same sort of legend. If all three agree increases, it's the red. But what you do note is that there's very little areas of decrease. There are some areas of no change, but mostly it's increases. And it's mostly the northern hemisphere, though you do see increases in Australia and parts of South America. So that's mid-century, end of the century. Same sort of pattern as the B1 scenario, is that end of century is much worse. You can see Europe spreads to the Iberian Peninsula and more of South America. And let's move on to the A2 scenario, mid-century, same legend, end of century, mid-century, end of century, mid-century. And it's all three scenarios have very similar agreement that cumulative DSR is going to increase significantly. So I had a manager, and he always would say when I published something or I had new exciting results, he'd say, so what? Okay. So here's the so what. Okay. And just for your information, this is a Landsat picture of Slave Lake, and that's part of the community. And you can see the two fingers of the fire, and this is the one that burnt into town. Modern fire management is challenging today. We just have to look. Canada, United States, and Australia are probably the leaders in the world, and we've been struggling. In California, in Texas, last year, over $5 billion, number of people died. We had problems in Alberta last year. Australia had serious issues, 2009. There's been problems in Russia, 2010, problems in the Mediterranean. And some of these are occurring in areas where we have the best fire management organizations in the world. But you can't put out all the fires all the time. They're very efficient, 95 to 99% of the fires they do put out. But the ones that do get away cause all the damage. And it's so in the future, if the intensity of the fires increase, it means you cannot attack the front of the fire because it's not safe for humans to be in front of it. Also, if it gets too intense, aircraft is not effective. So what I'm saying is if these fires become more intense, fire management will be less effective, even for modern fire management agencies. And less sophisticated fire management agencies will be completely overwhelmed. I also looked at fire season length. It was a simple temperature-based index, and you can see the kind of the modeled area in much of the equatorial tropical zones means that it's basically all your fire season in terms of temperature already. So the biggest increases are the northern hemisphere, and it's the same sort of pattern as I showed before. Three scenarios. This is the B1 for the three models. If they all agree, it's red. So the same sort of legend, and you can see the northern hemisphere fire season should increase. Most of the increases were around 20 days. So it's a significant lengthening of fire season. That's mid-century, end of century. Not much change. Most of the fire season changes will have happened by mid-century. This is A1B, same sort of pattern. And here's A2, same sort of pattern. Very consistent. We're going to have longer fire seasons, which isn't much of a surprise. Now, I'd like to shift gears and just talk about carbon for a couple of minutes, if I may. Fire in Canada plays a major role to determine whether our ecosystem or our forest is a source or a sink. In recent years, our forests have been a source of carbon due to things like mountain pine beetle and fire activity. And there's kind of three ways fire and carbon interact. First is through combustion, flaming and smoldering combustion. Greenhouse gases, including carbon, are released to the atmosphere. Decomposition. After fire goes through, there's a lot of dead organic material. This decomposes and releases carbon. And the third aspect is that many of the fires occur, in the, at least in the forest, in semi-mature to mature stands. And these are stand-renewing fires, so there's a new crop of vegetation which has a completely different carbon dynamics. It's a much better sink as it grows up. Generally, after a fire, it's a carbon source for anywhere from 2 to 15 years, and after that, it becomes a carbon sink again. So I do want to talk about peat. There's about 700 petagrams of carbon stored in the circumboreal forest. This is Siberia and Canada, Alaska, and it's about a third of the terrestrial carbon. And much of this is legacy carbon. It's been accumulating over thousands of years. Now, climate change will mean the thawing of permafrost, and there'll be more droughts, and peat fires will become more common. And peat fires can release significant amounts of greenhouse gases. Published work from Indonesia suggested that the fires in 1997 released 20 to 40% of global fossil fuel emissions, or the equivalent. Our peat reserves in the circumboreal dwarf anything in Indonesia, and peat fires can be hard to put out. They can burn right through winter and then start up again next spring. So it's a very serious issue that this could be a positive feedback. So the positive feedback is fossil fuels lead to warmer temperatures, more fire, and more fire leads to more greenhouse gases. Now, some people may argue that there's been warmer periods in the past and, you know, this has happened before. And to a degree, that is true. But the past is not an analog because the rapidity of the warming may make these peatland reserves extremely vulnerable, unlike the past. Options, adaptations, we can have updated enhanced fire danger rating systems, and we're working on that in Canada already. Global early warning systems, we're also working on that already. Regional cooperations, we have to learn to share resources. We already are doing this in the developed countries, but we have to do it in the developing countries. Training and education, FireWise, FireSmart program. And we have to enforce policies rather than just giving them lip service. So, in summary, fire and weather are strongly linked. A warmer world will have more fire. Changes in wildland fires may be the greatest early impact of climate change on forests and wildlands. Traditional approaches to fire management may no longer be viable, and there's a potential for significant positive feedback through peat fires and the need for international cooperation. Thank you.
That was Mike Flanagan speaking on wildfires and climate change at the special session of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in February 2012. You can download my Radio EcoShock interview with Mike Flanagan in the May 2011 program titled Flood, Fire, and Wind, Climate Shift. That's at ecoshock.org. It's a 13-minute interview. About 2 weeks after this broadcast, you can also download a free MP3 of Mike Flanagan's full speech at the AAAS from our Climate 2012 page. All of today's speakers will be there in full, plus this program. Can we say there are more fires now than at any time in human history? What about fires in the past hot ages in the previous greenhouse worlds? I listened to two presentations on the history of fire by Douglas Wolford from Canada's Wolford Laurier University and Richard Routledge, Simon Fraser University. The science was too complicated for radio broadcast. I came away thinking in the field of fire archaeology, if you want to call it that, it's still very young. Do we know enough to answer those questions, to compare our future to the distant past of fire? It sounds like much more research is needed.
Radio EcoShock.
Fire smoke travels huge distances, sometimes smudging out part of a continent. In the soot below, human lungs don't do very well. As we'll hear from our third speaker, hundreds of thousands of humans die every year from inhaling smoke from natural and agricultural fires. But first, you should hear this Canadian medical expert, Dr. Mike Brower. He explains big advances in predicting the smoke plumes so people with breathing difficulties can be warned and do something about it. It's almost like tornado warnings, only more accurate. Pharmacies can know when to stock up on inhalers, and Brower ends up with tips you can use to protect yourself if smoke fills up your air. Following the introduction by session organizer Charmaine Dean of Simon Fraser University, here is Mike Brower addressing a special session of the American Academy in February 2012.
I'm going to talk about health impacts of fire smoke. Most people thinking about fires and health actually think about property damage, direct influences of the fires themselves. But there is now quite a bit of evidence of impacts of smoke. And really, when we actually think about air pollution episodes in developed countries, we have done a pretty good job of dealing with extremes in air pollution in urban areas due to industrial emissions, traffic-related emissions. We still have sort of chronic exposure to pollutants from those sources. But really, one of the major, if not the major source of episodes of air pollution in developed countries are fire smoke. So in a location that's impacted by a fire smoke, that's almost certainly going to be the highest concentration so that population will experience that year. So just a little bit of background to put this in perspective, what do we know about air pollution and health? And specifically, I'm going to focus mostly on airborne particulate matter. This is the heart of the air pollution that we have the strongest associations with population health impacts. From studies that have been done now in over 400 cities in the world, we know that on days with the worst air pollution, more people die. So daily changes lead to more deaths. It's important to consider air pollution for any one individual. The individual risk is very small. But what makes it important from a public health perspective is that everybody is exposed. So the population impact can be very large. So everybody always asks me, you know, can you see a patient, you know, can you see air pollution disease? No, we can't. It's a contributing risk factor. But when we do these statistical associations, we can actually estimate the population impact. And you can contrast that with something like smoking, where we know the risk to an individual is very large. But fortunately, in a country like Canada, actually the population exposure to smoke, the proportion of the population that smokes is rather low and decreasing. That's a good thing. We also know that in more polluted areas, people die earlier than in less polluted areas. And the evidence base for that is somewhat smaller. We don't have 400 studies, but we have in the hundreds and 100 or so studies like that. This figure here is just to illustrate, if we're talking about something like death, which is very easy to understand, that's really sort of a tip of the iceberg phenomenon. The proportion of the population that may experience death as a result of air pollution, whether that's chronic exposure or an episode situation, is rather small. But underlying that are a whole other series of health impacts that actually affect a greater proportion of the population. And in some cases, these actually add up to sort of contribute to earlier death. So I'm actually going to be focusing on sort of two indicators that we've primarily used in our forest fire smoke work, and that will be a visit to a general practitioner and medication use. So these are things that sort of affect a somewhat larger proportion of the population, therefore easier to detect. And that's important when we talk about forest fires because often they don't actually impact large urban areas. So in order to get the statistical power to actually detect these sort of risks of air pollution exposure, we need large populations or sort of long time series of data in order to identify something like a death. Forest fires sometimes impact smaller communities, rural areas, and so we like some kind of an indicator that we're more likely to see a signal.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. And you are listening to a Radio EcoShock special on wildfires, the climate, and the health impacts on all of us. You've just heard the first part of a talk by Dr. Michael Brower from the University of British Columbia, Canada. It was delivered at the American Academy for the Advancement of Science Conference, February 19th, 2012, in Vancouver. When we return, Dr. Brower will explain why doctor's visits, inhaler sales, and other medical problems soar during smoke events. He's got some helpful suggestions of what people and communities can do to protect themselves. Then Dr. Faye Johnson from the University of Tasmania will give us the first estimates of the number of people killed by fire and smoke worldwide. I'm Alex Smith. Stay tuned to Radio EcoShock.